This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. A year after his death from COVID-19, residents in the Chinese city of Wuhan say they remain grateful to the whistleblower doctor who first sounded the alarm about the coronavirus outbreak before it received official recognition. Li Wenliang, and he's an ophthalmologist at a hospital in the city, became one of the most visible figures in the early days of the outbreak in Wuhan, where he tried to sound the alarm about its appearance, but was reprimanded by police for spreading rumors. Sinovac Biotech said on Saturday that its COVID-19 vaccine has been approved for use by the general public by China's medical products regulator. It marks the second vaccine approved for public use in China after one developed by a Beijing institute affiliated with state-owned China National Pharmaceutical Group, or Sinopharm, was approved in December. South Korea on Saturday eased curfews on more than 500,000 restaurants and other businesses outside the capital, Seoul, letting them stay open an hour later amid a backlash over tight curbs to contain COVID-19. After using aggressive testing and tracing to blunt several earlier waves of the coronavirus without drastic lockdowns, the authorities have imposed increasingly rigid social distancing rules as they fight the latest wave of the epidemic. Bulgaria will cull more than 160,000 ducks after an outbreak of bird flu on two duck farms, veterinary officials said on Saturday. The outbreak occurred at two farms owned by the same person, with more than 99,000 hens laying eggs there this week. This is VOA News. In Myanmar, thousands of people took to the streets of Yangon on Saturday to denounce this week's coup and demand the release of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi, despite a blockade on the internet by the junta. In an upwelling of anger in the country's largest city, protesters chanted, "Military dictator, fail, fail, democracy, win, win," and they held up banners reading, "Against military dictatorship." Bystanders offered them food and water. A senior United Nations official has warned that the risk of atrocity crimes in Ethiopia remains high and likely to get worse if the country does not urgently combat ethnic violence, stigmatization, hate speech, and religious tensions. The UN Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide said she had received reports of serious human rights violations and abuses by the parties to the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region and their allies. A second senior leader of a vast drug syndicate has been arrested, a Thai narcotics official said, as a transnational dragnet tightens on the Samgor Group, which police say dominate the $70 billion annual Asia-Pacific drug trade. The October arrest of Hong Kong citizen Lee Chung Chak in Bangkok preceded last month's high-profile arrest in the Netherlands of Si Chi Lop, a Chinese-born Canadian national who police suspect is the top leader of the syndicate, also called The Company. Twitter's refusal to comply with an Indian government directive to block more than 250 accounts and posts has put the social media giant at the center of a political firestorm in one of its key markets. Government officials, business people, and ordinary citizens are split over free speech and the U.S. company's compliance practices in a controversy that comes soon after Twitter's top lobbyist in India resigned. And in Tunisia, police locked down a large area of central Tunis on Saturday in hopes of dampening a major protest backed by the country's powerful labor union. Protesters were marking the 2013 killing of a prominent activist, and they're also upset by police abuses that they say have imperiled the freedoms won in the 2011 revolution, which triggered the Arab Spring. For more on these stories, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We believe in the nations of Africa, in the continent-wide spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation. And through the challenges ahead, although they're great, there is no doubt that our nations, our people, the African Union, were up to this task. I hope I can be with you next time in person. I want to thank you, though.
A two-day virtual summit of African leaders and government is underway. This as the U.S. President Joe Biden wishes the leaders well.
If the military strategy, they think they are smart, no problem. One thing we can assure the Nigerian people is that you see this matter will never be swept under the carpet. It will never be swept under the carpet. And these guys, they are going to have their day in court at the ICC.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari comes under criticism for nominating former military officials to ambassadorial positions.
So those who are saying it was a free and fair election, why was the internet cut off? Why was the military deployed so heavily? Because if Uganda is Somalia, Central African Republic, or that kind of thing, clearly showing that Museveni had a lot to hide.
And Uganda's main opposition leader, Bobi Wine, calls on the international community to speak out against human rights abuses in the East African country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A two-day summit of African heads of state and government ends Sunday. This year's meeting is being held virtually due to the ongoing global coronavirus pandemic. The key outcomes of the summit will include the decisions and declarations of the African leaders made by members of the African Union's Executive Council. U.S. President Joe Biden had this to say ahead of the African-wide gathering.
Hello, everyone. I'm honored to send the best wishes of the people of the United States in advance of the 34th African Union Summit. This past year has shown us how interconnected our world is and how our fates are bound up together. That's why my administration is committing to rebuilding our partnership around the world and re-engaging with international institutions like the African Union. We must all work together to advance our shared vision of a better future, a future of growing trade and investment that advances prosperity for all our nations, a future that advances lives of peace and security for all our citizens, a future committed to investing in our democratic institutions and promoting the human rights of all people, women and girls, LGBTQ individuals, people with disabilities, and people of every ethnic background, religion, and heritage. To reach this future, we also must confront the serious challenges we face. That includes investing more in global health, defeating COVID-19, and working to prevent, detect, and respond to future health crises, and partnering with the African CDC and other institutions to advance health security, raising our climate ambitions, and ensuring developing nations can mitigate and adapt to climate impacts that are already causing pain, and engaging in sustained diplomacy in connection with the African Union to address conflicts that are costing lives all across the African continent. None of this is going to be easy, but the United States stands ready now to be your partner in solidarity, support, and mutual respect. We believe in the nations of Africa, in the continent-wide spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation, and through the challenges ahead, although they're great, there is no doubt that our nations, our people, the African Union, we're up to this task. I hope I can be with you next time in person. I want to thank you, though. Thank you. May God bless you all.
That was U.S. President Joe Biden. He spoke from the capital, Washington, D.C. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has nominated four former military commanders for ambassadorial roles after their resignations last week. The president overhauled the military's top command in an effort to quell insecurity across the country. He accepted the resignations of the chief of defense staff and the heads of the army, navy, and air force, and approved their retirement from service. On Thursday, he forwarded their names to the Senate for approval for the diplomatic posts. The Senate is likely to approve their nominations. Nigeria has been struggling to end the decades-long Boko Haram insurgency in the northeast, as well as kidnappings and banditry across the country. The president has also extended the tenure of the Inspector General of Police by 3 months. Deji Adeyanju is the convener of the pressure group called Concern Nigeria. He says the president's nomination of the former security leaders is an attempt to shield them from investigation and prosecution by the International Criminal Court, ICC. His group has petitioned the Hague-based court to investigate the former military leaders. Mr. Adeyanju tells me that Concern Nigeria is committed to the investigation and prosecution of those responsible for the gross violation of the rights of Nigerians.
Yes, it's just an attempt to shield the ex-service chiefs who committed various crimes against the Nigerian people. So we see this as an attempt, you know, to try and provide some diplomatic immunity to the service chiefs in order to ensure that they do not face trial or are not held accountable for their actions. However, we are very, very confident that these guys are going to have their day, you know, at the ICC, and that no gimmicks, no tricks, you know, can prevent the inevitable from happening. It's just a matter of time. They are definitely not going to get away with all the atrocities they have committed.
But it is the prerogative of the president, and for that matter, the Constitution gives him the power to choose whoever he wants to work with. And he's chosen this man to be his top envoys to several countries. Why do you think this is an attempt to shield them for alleged crimes they might have committed while serving in the Nigerian military?
You know, Buhari, by his track record and his history, has never been someone who has been in a hurry to do anything. You know, this is somebody who, 4 years under him, his ministers did not reshuffle the cabinet. You know, this is somebody who did not appoint ministers until after 6 months. He has never been in a hurry. This is the fastest appointment ever. This is somebody who is not in a hurry to change the Inspector General of Police. So, people are not fools. Nigerians know what is going on, and we in particular, we know what he's trying to do, because he's the one that supervised and instructed many of them to carry out the crimes against humanity that they have done. And that's why we say we don't even want to go to that end yet. For everyone that goes into public office, there's always an expiry date for the office. So we'll wait till when we get to that bridge. And when we get to that bridge, we are going to cross the bridge. However, for the service chiefs who have just miraculously, you know, been made envoys, you know, we are not bothered by his actions. However, one thing that we can assure the Nigerian people of is that at the end of the day, you know, these guys who have done one thing or the other wrong, you know, will be made to face the consequences of their actions.
Nigerians are saying that the appointment for top ambassadorial positions shows that the president reposes confidence in them. You deny that?
Nobody is saying that. If you say Bukata is happy with his appointment, if you say the service teams are happy with their appointment, if you say their family members are happy, go to social media, go everywhere, look at how dissatisfied, look at even opinion holders in the country, you know, senior citizens, everybody is so disappointed, you know, that these are people who, when they took over office in 2015, insecurity was just restricted to the northeast, just Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe. Today, there is no state, including the president's state, that has not been overrun by insecurity, bandits, Boko Haram, criminal elements. So this is an award for a job well done by destabilizing the country, by destroying the security architecture of the country, you know, by various forms of human rights abuses, by extrajudicial killing, so many, too numerous to mention. So this is the way to compensate people for committing crimes against humanity. And somebody will say Nigerians are happy. How can any Nigerian who truly loves this country be happy with what's going on in the country today? My own country, I have not committed any crime. I'm a law-abiding Fulani. That me, I should leave my own country. And the person threatening me is a non-state actor, because the government have failed and citizens have not taken the law and breaking the law. If the president can break the law to appoint the Inspector General of Police, which term has expired, who the law says you cannot do that but the president is breaking the law, why wouldn't normal citizens who are not state actors also be breaking the law? So how can anybody simply say that people are happy with what is going on in the country?
So where currently is your case? That you petitioned the ICC to investigate the former...
Yes, the ICC, you see, we will not want to divulge too much information. The ICC have responded to us. We can assure the Nigerian people. That's why I'm saying that. We were going to cross the bridge when we get there. We will not talk too much. The president thinks he's smart. The immediate past service chief, they think they are smart. No problem. One thing we can assure the Nigerian people is that you see this matter will never be swept under the carpet. It will never be swept under the carpet. And these guys, they're going to have their day in court at the ICC.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of the pressure group called Concerned Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, an appeals court at The Hague in the Netherlands recently ordered Royal Dutch Shell to pay compensation to victims of two oil spills in Nigeria's Ogoniland in the Niger Delta in 2004 and 2008. The court further ordered the company to clean up the polluted communities and restore the livelihoods of the affected victims. The case was brought by four farmers and environmental group Friends of the Earth seeking reparations for lost income from contaminated land and waterways in the heart of Nigeria's oil industry. For more, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Emmanuel Deye, president of the social cultural group Kagote Ogoni, on the significance of the ruling.
We are excited because we started talking about this as far back as the early 90s, and we're not taken seriously by the government of Nigeria, not until recently, that UNEP also affirmed the same thing, which the court has just confirmed. So we are excited that at least it's no longer an accusation, it's no longer what people thought that Ogoni people were making noise, but it's reality.
After years of going through the courts for this matter, what does this ruling mean for the Ogoni people?
It means a lot. When you have an expectation, you go to court and on and on and on, and one day that expectation becomes a reality. I mean, it's a dream come true.
Do you see this ruling as a failure of the Nigerian judicial system?
Yeah, of course. You know, the Nigerian system, we all belong here, is not very strong. Our institutions are not strong. Sometimes power, sometimes money dictates what happens. So I would want to thank God we have this opportunity in far away country where we do not exert any form of influence. We do not have any power. We do not have any connection. Just the law.
What has been the repercussion of this spill on your environment and the lives of your people?
It has, to a large extent, affected the livelihood of our people. Our farmland are no longer fertile, are no longer very useful. The water we drink is polluted. The air is also polluted. I don't know when last you were around. There is what you call black soot that is very common. If you go out in a white shirt, by the time you come back, the color of your shirt will be black. If you remove your shoes and walk on the tile floor, the sole of your feet will be black. If you spread the white cloth outside, you will see tiny drops of that black soot on it. So we breathe in bad air, we farm on polluted land. Even our swamp, our rivers are also polluted, and those are the sources of livelihood of our people.
What about the health of Ogoni people?
Of course, if you're breathing in something that is not permissible, these tiny particles, you definitely know that a lot of people will come down with illnesses, and those who are not very strong will also be predisposed to some infection. You also know that UNEP, in their last report, said the level of benzene, a carcinogenic substance, in our water is too high. So this, in summary, will tell you what we are going through as a people.
There are reports that your people have run out of patience with the government despite this court ruling, and that by next month, you might express your disappointment in other ways. What exactly do you plan to do?
The government of Buhari, actually, we must give him some credit. But as we speak, IPEP has not delivered the most basic thing that we have impact on human lives, that is water in the community. So our people are
already to peace, but the new Minister of Environment promised that there are some structural changes that are being done to make it more effective. So we are giving him up to the end of next month. By March, and we don't see anything, we are going to march on the street.
Dr. Emmanuel Deya is president of the social cultural group Kagote Ogoni. He spoke with VOA Sinead Wofo from the Niger Delta State in Nigeria. In Uganda, the presidential candidate for the Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, is calling on the European Union to initiate an independent audit of the recent elections. Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine, insists he defeated incumbent President Yoweri Museveni in the presidential vote. Citing voter irregularities and rigging, he has rejected the outcome of the elections. His party has since petitioned the Supreme Court to challenge the election results. At a meeting with representatives of the European Union this week, Wine also called on the international community to hold responsible top government officials responsible for the violence targeting opposition leaders during the election process. Joel Senyonyi, the spokesperson for the NUP, was present at the meeting. He tells me that he hopes the international community will speak out about ongoing gross violations of human rights in Uganda.
It was a fruitful meeting. Our appeal to them was, as friends of Uganda, their countries, you know, they're friends of Uganda, that they should really speak out about the ills that are happening, the brutality that is being meted out against Ugandans. And for us, that's important, because you see, Uganda is part of the international community. So our president said that he cannot, you know, go around killing people who don't support him, maiming them, arresting others in a manner so wanton. And it's okay. It can't be okay just because Uganda is a sovereign country. You know, and that's what we are saying, that please hold us accountable the same way we would hold any other country accountable, because we are part of the international community. And so that was our message to them, that the people of Uganda are waiting to keep hearing them speak out for their good, to hold their fellow leader, Mr. Museveni, accountable, because Museveni doesn't listen to Ugandans anymore. Those who oppose him, those who criticize, you know, the evil done by his government, he just kills them, he arrests them, and so on. So that's why we are hoping that his fellow leaders within the international community can speak out and say, look, yes, Uganda is a sovereign state, but this is wrong. You can't treat people this way.
Did they make any promises about some of the concerns you've raised in terms of holding government officials accountable for those who have committed gross human rights violations?
Yeah, they say that always, that, you know, they always meet up with government and people in government, and they said they'll put these issues to them. So let's wait and see what happens.
What about the issue of an audit? Because I understand Bobi Wine raised the issue of a possible audit of the elections to find out from them, because they also wrote a preliminary report about how the election was conducted.
Yeah, of course, we discussed the election, and I mean, they did have observers everywhere. Actually, one of our concerns was that government denied the EU observers that, you know, had fixed interest in observing the election. So they didn't have an observer team, so there's very little, even from their own admission, there's very little that they were able to see. You know, yes, a few of them were able to move around, but they generally did not have an observer team. So, again, we wait to hear what they were able to gather from the very few of them that had chance to move around.
Your party has officially petitioned the Supreme Court to challenge the outcome of the election. Yes. Some people are saying that is a wild goose chase and that there's no precedent that the election results could be overturned because even the judiciary might not necessarily be independent. So why make such a move, some people are asking?
Just like Sam asked us, you're going into an election, the managers of the election, the electoral commission, is appointed by Museveni, it is controlled by him. So why go into the election well knowing that it's Museveni who has organized the election and he's ultimately going to declare himself winner? For us, all of this is part of our struggle to see change, and we are saying we're going to use all the legal means available. You know, so yes, we're going to an election, we'll go to court as one of the avenues to say we are law-abiding, we're not for violence, we want to keep testing the system. But ultimately, we're saying everything should be out there for Ugandans to see. Even as the courts operate, they need to know that they really have been put to the test by the Ugandan people, and we hope that they will serve the people of Uganda and not Mr. Museveni.
Some Ugandans are saying that there were some voter irregularities, but they were not necessarily enough that could overturn or affect the outcome of the election. They said this has been the reasons Supreme Court judges have made over the past years, and that President Museveni truly won the election in spite of the popularity of your party and your presidential candidate, Bobi Wine. Your response to that?
Well, I don't know who those Ugandans are. Obviously, if you ask people in government or government sympathizers, they'll tell you everything was okay, you know. But if you're on social media, you can clearly see, and that's why they were cutting it off. That's why Museveni cut off the internet, because he knew the mess he was about to create, you know. But anyway, all the evidence is beginning to come out. So those who are saying it was a free and fair election, why was the internet cut off? Why was the military deployed so heavily? It's as if Uganda is Somalia, or Central African Republic, or that kind of thing. Clearly showing that Museveni had a lot to hide.
Now that you have petitioned the court, what's next for you?
Well, we are in court. Let's wait and see what comes out, and we'll determine how we proceed after that.
Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for the Ugandan Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. South Sudan has imposed a one-month partial lockdown after a jump in coronavirus cases. Africa's youngest nation has confirmed more than 4,000 cases and 65 deaths. But some residents worry this first lockdown since June could hurt people's livelihoods. For VOA, Winnie Sirino reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
South Sudan's National Task Force on COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, said Wednesday the partial lockdown was necessary after a surge in cases. Task Force member Dr. Richard Lacou said virus cases have doubled in the past week.
In the last 7 days, we have recorded 218 confirmed cases compared to the week before, which is the week of 20 to 26, we have 140 cases. But the week 27 to the 2nd of February, we have 218 cases, which shows almost doubling of the cases along the 2 weeks. And this shows that the positivity rate has been increasing from last week to this week.
The chairman of the task force, Hassan Abdelbaji, said the new lockdown measures affect all businesses and events that attract large crowds.
Ban all the social gatherings, such as sporting events, religious events, including Sunday prayers, mosque prayers, funerals, wedding ceremony, and political events. 2, closure of all three schools, universities, and all the other institutions of learning, except classes which are required for examination with the observation of strict protective measures.
Abdelbaji said while bars and clubs will be closed, restaurants and tea shops are allowed to operate but must adhere to strict COVID-19 measures. Buses and taxis must reduce passenger numbers by half, he said, and enforce wearing face masks and social distancing. He added that all incoming passengers on international flights must have test results showing they are free of the coronavirus. On the streets of Juba, there was mixed reaction to the restrictions. 35-year-old Godfrey Fred said he is worried the lockdown will affect people's incomes.
If we don't move, so survival itself will be very, very difficult. So at least we need our government to take another measure, not to close everything, because there are very many ways of preventing disease.
34-year-old Data Gordon has doubt the lockdown can be enforced.
I don't see this new lockdown being implemented because it's going to be a ground for corrupt practices like bribery for law enforcers who will definitely take and will get back to where we started.
57-year-old William Edward said the lockdown was a good idea to reduce the virus spread, but said ordinary South Sudanese would need government support.
The government have to provide things for the people to support them while they're in the lockdown period to help them. So as a South Sudan, we are suffering a lot. People are suffering. It's not easy to get food. They can break the lockdown because of the situation that they're facing.
South Sudan imposed its first lockdown in March last year, but lifted it in June after the level of reported COVID-19 cases dropped. Winnie Serino for VOA News, Juba.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association has petitioned a high court to compel the administration in Harare to publish its coronavirus vaccination plan. This after the group accused the government of weaponizing the fight to limit the spread of the coronavirus by clamping down on critics, an accusation the government denies. Zikamai Bere is the national director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association. He says the group's latest newsletter details major human rights developments in the Southern African country. Supporters of the government say law and order must be enforced irrespective of the ongoing effort to stop the spread of the disease. They also say accusations of abuses contained in the newsletter of the rights groups are regrettable. For more on the alleged human rights violation in Zimbabwe, I read Zimakai Bere, the national director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association.
The COVID-19 situation has gotten worse, owing to the opening of the borders during the festive season. And now we have entered again level 4 lockdown. The human rights implications of that is that it has destroyed livelihoods. And in addition to that, the government has not come up with any mechanism to provide safety nets to the affected communities. And then if you add to that the continued attacks on activists, or what we are calling the weaponization of COVID-19, where the government targets activists and they throw them in prison where they are in danger of contracting COVID-19. That is meant to intimidate and throw fear within the activist community.
So would you say that the respect for human rights in Zimbabwe remains the same or has worsened within this context of this latest update?
Yes, we have seen the rearrest of Jessica Hopewell Chimono, the MDC spokesperson Fadai Maere, on fleeing the charges of tweeting. So the situation indeed has not improved.
Has your organization engaged the government about some of these concerns? Because some Zimbabweans are saying that the focus right now has been to combat the coronavirus in Zimbabwe. Do you think the respect for human rights as well as the fight against the coronavirus can go hand in hand, and one is not supposed to be prioritized over the other? Is that the stance of your organization?
The stance of our organization is that human rights must be at the center of the fight against the COVID-19. Human rights cannot fully suspended because of the fight against COVID-19, because the fight itself is a fight for the right to life. So the measures which the government has been taking on the pretext that they are doing so to prevent COVID-19 have actually been responsible for the spread of COVID-19. For example, we have engaged the government, the police, and asked them not to detain people for minor offenses because there are no COVID-19 safe facilities in detention centers. But the police go ahead and detain people for offenses like not wearing a mask. Then they throw them in a truck with 50 other people who are not wearing a mask. Now, that cannot be called law enforcement for the sake of COVID-19. That is actually law enforcement that is making worse the situation. Then secondly, we have said that beyond just the lockdown, the government is required by the Constitution of Zimbabwe to take positive steps to make sure that everyone has got access to health care. So beyond just locking down, they need to allocate funds to fight COVID-19, but they have not been doing that. We have likened this conduct to a person who sees a snake in their yard, then they lock themselves in the house and hope that by some act of grace, the snake will disappear. That in itself happens to be a threat to the ultimate right to life within the COVID-19 situation.
So moving forward, what do you see the respect of human rights situation in Zimbabwe? Because some Zimbabweans are saying, in spite of the fact that the government is putting on effort to limit the spread of the coronavirus, those who break the law cannot be let go. There has to be an enforcement of law to ensure law and order in Zimbabwe. What do you say to that?
What we think should be done is what we have done now as the human rights. We have approached the High Court seeking to compel the government of Zimbabwe to publish, disseminate their COVID-19 vaccination plan. And secondly, to make available resources for that entire process. We believe this information is not only in public interest, but it is for the purposes of accountability for us to actually see that government is taking steps to ensure that we safeguard the right to health.
Dikamai Bere is the National Director for the Zimbabwean Human Rights Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. The United Nations says that the Ethiopian government is preventing aid from reaching non-government-controlled rural areas in the Tigray region, where most of the province's 2.3 million people live and are in dire need. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Violent clashes continue in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region, 3 months after the government launched a military offensive on the regional capital, Mekele. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says humanitarian conditions in the region are alarming and rapidly deteriorating. It says millions of people are in dire need of food, water, and other essential relief and services. However, it says aid workers are unable to reach most of the rural areas in Tigray, where the greatest number of people in need are living. UN officials say insecurity and bureaucratic obstacles are preventing aid workers from accessing those areas. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says government clearances needed to move the necessary staff into Tigray have not been received.
An increasing amount of humanitarian cargo has been mobilized, but without staff and access, they won't reach the people who need it the most, especially in rural areas. Access to the countryside is mostly blocked for both UN agencies and NGOs, and no humanitarian assistance is taking place in non-government control areas.
Laerke notes aid is available for people living in towns along the main roads from Mekele towards Shire, which are controlled by federal government forces. He says people in rural areas, where two-thirds of Tigray's population live, are not so fortunate. He says economic activity and access to essential services, including electricity, telecommunications, cash, and fuel, are largely disrupted. He says hunger reportedly is growing.
Lack of food in markets is reported as the conflict broke out during harvest season, leaving crops unharvested. Key supply routes to Tigray are still cut. And malnutrition among the population was already on the rise because of COVID-19 and the desert locust situation.
Laerke says more than 70 humanitarian staffers are still waiting for their clearances in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. He adds they are ready to move into Tigray to resume aid distribution as soon as the government gives them the go-ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Situations come and go. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Another day, another goal. Another day to be a mighty warrior. And though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll be alright. Through the fire, I feel healed.
shop. Cash out. Only maga. Bila. Small money. Fall out. Who's them boat? Gone now. You get the shop clients. Lock them. If you know get money, leave them. EFC symbol. Japa. Show me 60. Load them. Cash out. Cash out. Only maga. Bila. Small money. Fall out. Who's them boat? Gone now. You get the shop clients. Lock them. If you know get money, leave them.
tusafiri kati ya mioyo yetu
baby, I love you.
you swear. Oh, your body, I love to care. Can I look you, I cannot bear. Showtime, showtime. Every time you know love too sweet. Come here, not being nowhere. You give me chills, it run me crazy. Showtime, showtime. Let me go, guys. Drop it, baby. Drop it, drop it. Let it go, guys. Drop it, baby. Let it go. Showtime, showtime. Every time you know love too sweet. Come here, not being nowhere. You give me chills, it run me crazy. Showtime, showtime. Oh, yeah. Nani pulls that road.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, an old monkey never forgets how to climb trees. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.